Hello, listeners of Retelling the Bible. I've got a little extra treat for you today. A little while ago, I sat down with my good friends over at the Word in Black and Red podcast, and we had a fantastic conversation about one of my favorite Bible stories, one that I've obviously done on this podcast, the story of Tamar. It was so good, I asked if I could share it with my listeners as well. So here it is. There is a warning. This is a frank discussion that touches on issues of sex and sexuality and sexual activity and does not have clean language. If you're okay with that, great. Give it a listen. If not, totally understand.
The following podcast is banned in the state of Florida for talking about a dangerous leftist book, the Bible. Like the Bible, this podcast contains frank discussions on sensitive topics, including sex, violence, and cursing. Please proceed with caution. Let them thank the Lord for God's faithful love and God's wondrous works for all people. Because God satisfied the one who is parched with thirst, and God filled up the hungry with good things. This is the Word in Black and Red. Hello, and welcome to the Word in Black and Red, where we read the Bible from a leftist and liberationist perspective to elucidate the way people of faith and their comrades can understand the Bible as a source of healing, love, and liberation for all people. I am your host, Michael Belong, the wise old Lama MB, joined today once again by the wonderful L, our perennial co-host, who's always willing to step in, the wonderful W. Scott McCandless from Retelling the Bible, and a new co-host but longtime listener and supporter, Darth, a.k.a. Ben. Ben, would you tell us a little bit more about yourself? What's your political tendency, your religious background, and how can we connect with you?
Sure thing, Micah. Thanks for having me. So I was raised a conservative Christian. By the time I was like teenager, 14, 15, started thinking, oh, this doesn't feel good. My conscience is definitely leading me away from this. So then I just started getting progressively more and more left. Never did the horseshoe down in the atheism. I was always a Christian. But yeah, definitely went from gay people should be married to hold on. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Why was there a problem with that? So then progressively further and further from there. Politically, say democratic socialist. But the more I hear about anarcho-communism, the more I'm like, you know, that sounds really nice. I kind of like that. So we keep bringing that up and maybe you'll convert me. And as for where people can find me, most active on the Discord. So if you're listening to this, you've probably already seen me once or twice. Darth2514 on the Discord. I have a Reddit. I mostly just use it to doom scroll at work.
Yeah, I wish I could get off of Reddit, as does my wife. While we're talking about the sins of marriage, Genesis 38. this passage is a tried and true story that you do not hear preached in church very often. I think the common lectionary skips it. So this is, of course, never before heard if you are in a mainline church, a Bible story. So I am excited to dive on in and learn about the origin of every teenage boy's fear of masturbation. So Genesis 38. At that time, Judah moved away from his brothers and settled near an Adullamite named Hirah. Then Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her. After he slept with her, she became pregnant and gave birth to a son, whom she named Er. She became pregnant again, gave birth to a son, and named him Onan. Then she gave birth to one more son, and named him Shelah. She was in Chezib when she gave birth to him. Judah married his eldest son, Er, to a woman named Tamar. But the Lord considers Judah's oldest son, Er, immoral, and the Lord put him to death. Judah said to Onan, "Go to your brother's wife, do your duty as her brother-in-law, and provide children for your brother." Onan knew the children wouldn't be his, so when he slept with his brother's wife, he wasted his semen on the ground so that he wouldn't give his brother children. The Lord considered what he did as wrong and put him to death too. Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Stay as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up." He thought Shelah would die like his brothers had, so Tamar went and lived in her father's household. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. Then after a period of mourning, he and his neighbor Hirah the Adullamite went up to Timnah, to those who were shearing his sheep. Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is now on his way up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So Tamar took off the clothing she wore as a widow, covered herself with a veil, put on makeup, and sat down at the entrance of Enam on the road to Timnah. Since she realized that although Shelah had already grown up, she hadn't been given to him as a wife. Judah saw her and thought she was a prostitute because she had covered her face. He turned to her beside the road and said, "Let me sleep with you," because he didn't know she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me for sleeping with you?" He said, "I will give you a kid goat from my flock." She said, "Only if you give me some deposit as security to guarantee that you will send it." He said, "What kind of deposit should I give you?" And she said, "Your seal, its cord, and the staff in your hand." He gave these to her, slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. Then she got up, left, and took off her veil, dressing once again in the clothing she wore as a widow. Judah sent the kid goat with his neighbor Hurah the Adullamite, so he could take back the deposits from the woman. But he couldn't find her. He asked the locals of that place, "Where is the consecrated worker who was at Enam on the road?" But they said, "There's no consecrated worker here." So he went back to Judah and said, "I couldn't find her. The locals even said, 'There's no holy woman here.'" Judah said, "Let her keep everything so we aren't laughed at. I did send this kid goat, but you couldn't find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has become a prostitute and is now pregnant because of it." And Judah said, "Bring her out so that she may be burned." When she was brought out, she sent this message to her father-in-law, "I'm pregnant by the man who owns these things. See if you recognize whose seal, cord, and staff these are." Judah recognized them and said, "She's more righteous than I am, because I didn't allow her to marry my son Shelah." Judah never knew her intimately again. When she gave birth, she discovered she had twins in her womb. At birth, one boy put out his hand, and the midwife took it and tied a red thread on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." As soon as he pulled his hand back, his brother came out, and she said, "You've burst out on your own." So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother with a red thread on his hand came out, and he was named Zerah. So this weird story, as I say so often on this podcast, is a story ultimately about justice, about what is owed to someone and how those things can play out. With a little bit of a note of trickster, the value of being a trickster in religious literature here. But I just want to throw this out to y'all and talk to you about your first impressions of this story, how you've grown up understanding this story, what influence this story had in your lives, and what in the world this has to do with masturbation.
Yeah, so this story was probably, like, I remember, like, the first time I read that, or, like, consciously remember reading the story, I was a teenager, and I was like, "Wait, the Bible has sex in it? What?" I had that Sunday school understanding of the Bible, and now here's like, okay, this is not, does not fit into that worldview at all. So now I have to look at the Bible in a different way, and like that was like the beginning of where I look at the Bible now. I was like, okay, like, well, the, you know, when Paul's like, "Oh, I don't like women to speak in church," it's like, well, shut up, Paul. That's not right. Also, when I was, you know, I was being an edgy teenager, and I'd be like, hey, did you know that there's a story about like Judah sleeping with his daughter-in-law in the Bible? Like, it's in the Bible. It's Genesis 38. Go read it. It's messed up, dude. It's messed up.
I remember when I was young, coming across the story of Jael, and Jael smashing a tent peg through somebody's head. I don't remember finding this one as a young person. If I had, I would have talked about it more, I'm sure. I mean, I remember growing up, you know, as a young man, you do grow up and you often get a lot of shame around the whole question of masturbation. I don't think I necessarily connected this story to that, because it's pretty obviously not about that. But I do know the history behind it and how people used this story and this passage to make people feel ashamed of things like masturbation. But I think even the first time I read it, I said, well, that's obviously not about that.
I just want to share that because I was not a young man growing up. The first time I really heard this story be talked about is Spencer calling it sperm thievery, which after deep diving into this story a lot more, it is absolutely no sperm thievery is occurring here, in my opinion.
No, absolutely not. And we will definitely dive more into sperm thievery. But just to give people a little bit of a context here, this story is often used by conservatives and fundamentalists to argue that masturbation is sinful. And the reason they do that is because when the Old Testament talks about any bodily fluid, whether it's blood, menstrual blood, or ejaculation, the Bible has a lot of concern about it, right? And the reason for this is that there is all of this concern about mixing up things that are unlike each other in the sacrificial system, right? And so if you have one of these signs of life about you, right, one of these life-giving things about you, you are supposed to go and become clean of that thing before you go and offer a sacrifice, because a sacrifice is the ritual deadening of something, right? It's the ritual killing of something. And so you're not supposed to mix those two things, right? Oftentimes people will say, when they're trying to dismiss what's going on in Leviticus, they'll point out the fact that you're not supposed to have two different types of clothes intermingled with each other, right? You're not supposed to have wool and cotton in the same shirt. Well, most of us are breaking that violation all the time, right? But is that because there's something sacred about it? No, it's because you're supposed to not intermix these things that are in some ways counterposed to each other, right? In some ways defiling one another because they are intermixed. Now, we have a lot of different opinions about that, right? We can look back on this passage and say, well, that's reflecting this need to build a nationalistic myth, that there needs to be some pure culture, right, that is only consisting of the Jewish people and nobody else. And so you can't intermix because that creates a perversion, right? And we can look in our society and say, well, actually, we see that we have a lot of strength in diversity. And here, even in this text, it's a Jewish man who's marrying a Canaanite woman, and the Canaanite becomes the more righteous person than the Jewish person. And so that intermixing benefits the people of God rather than detracts from them. And Tamar ends up becoming an ancestor of Jesus, right? One of these women who, one of the very few women in the genealogy of Jesus who are noted because of the things that they do that are really important and advance the people of God. So all of that to say that this is the story that people say you can't wank because of, but actually this story has nothing to do with wanking, and please masturbate to your heart's content as long as it's not hurting anybody else while you're doing it.
I mean, there was actually a concerted effort to take this story and make it into something scary and dangerous. I traced it back to, I think, 1839 is the first written medical textbook that refers to onanism and warns that this is an activity that will lead to insanity and illness and all kinds of things. So in that sort of Victorian era, there was a concerted effort to actually convince people that this was sinful, but also dangerous and deadly, and it would drive you crazy. And they used this story to do it. It was an intentional campaign, really.
Well, and like it plays into this whole philosophy that if you can take away the joy of living, that somehow that makes the joy of heaven more satisfying in some way. But if you're just trying to eliminate all that's good about life now, like enjoying your breakfast or, you know, enjoying a wank, then like when you're taking away those things, then it looks very austere, right? It looks like we can't have joy in this world. It looks like the only joy that we can have is in heaven. Scott was saying in our intro conversation, longtime listeners might know that we do a little warm-up question a lot of the time, and Scott was pointing out the fact that at the end of a lot of hymns, it goes into this conversation about heaven, right? Where like whatever the rest of the song was about, it always ends on this line, or almost always ends on this line about heaven. That is an escapism, right? It's a getting out of here. It's we'll leave this terrible world behind and then go somewhere else good. But that is a form of docetism, right? That's a heresy that says that this world is evil, these bodies are terrible, all these things. What we truly are, just our souls will escape into heaven when we're finally free of this place. And that's a dangerous heresy to hold on to.
this is just like an aside that kind of goes with that. But as Micah knows, I've been reading about Dorothy Day a lot recently. And she had this extremely puritanical phase after starting the Catholic worker movement. But that phase started with her like getting involved with a priest who is like, the greatest good of all is giving up like the good things of the world. It's kind of like in that line of to enjoy holiness or whatever, you gotta like stop enjoying the good things that God created on this earth, which is like, why? Don't do that. And like during this period of time, Dorothy Day actually like really pushed away a lot of people in her life, including her daughter, Tamar. I mean, eventually she came out of her like puritanical phase. It didn't last forever. And she started like rejoining the good things in life. Like even during this phase, she would not give up coffee. She refused, but it did get her to quit smoking, which Tamar was like, well, at least there was that.
Every once in a while, these things have good consequences. But for the most part, like eliminating the joy of life is just that, right? One of my favorite verses is John 10:10, that Christ has come to bring life in all its fullness, right? That life is not something to be avoided. Life is not something to be run away from. Life is something meant to be enjoyed, right? And a grand part of the capitalist conspiracy against all of us is that it makes us think that work is the primary purpose of life. No, work is something we do so that we can enjoy life, right? And it shouldn't be 8 hours a day. It should be much less so that we have far more time to enjoy the rest of our life. Let's dive a little bit more directly into the story, because I think that there's so much going on here. So Air, first off, talk to me more about why is this happening to Judah?
Well, why is this happening to Judah? Well, I mean, this whole story takes place right in the middle of the whole Joseph story. And there is this incredible story where Judah is among, and all the brothers are jealous of who? Joseph, who is the favorite, who is the eldest son of his father's favorite wife. And everybody hates Joseph, but guess which one comes up with this brilliant idea of selling Joseph off to as a slave and then telling Father Jacob that Joseph is dead. That's all Judah's idea, you know. And he's the one who put his father through that hell, right? And did it out of hatred for the favored brother. And isn't it kind of ironic that in Judah's own family, he's got three sons, the eldest and the second son. And once again, you have, I believe, the same enmity between the first and the second son. And they both end up dead. There's a bit of retribution going on in this story. And Judah is dealing with all of this grief and loss, maybe because he's causing it to his own father.
That's just what the Midrash says, that this is happening to Judah because he put Israel through this by, like, lying to him about like, oh, your son's dead. So God was like, well, you're going to know this pain, but for reals. And also it kind of speaks to Judah's character about like not completing things, because Judah could have saved Joseph completely and he didn't. Just like Judah could have taken care of Tamar, but he didn't. So there has to be some other intervention in there.
I was thinking, because Judah and his line ends up being the important one, right? Like, you have, like, David and then Jesus. So I was thinking, it's like, oh, like, Judah's totally the brother who tried to save Joseph, right? And then I went back and I was like, oh, no. No, he's not. He's not it. No, he's bad. He's real bad. Judah's kind of got this coming. Like, as horrible as all of this is, like, he's kind of brought it on himself because he, you know, brought his father such grief and then ran away.
Well, so I want to push back on this interpretation a little bit, because like Reuben and Judah both All right. Well, it seemed to me like only Reuben and Judah don't want Joseph outright dead. The rest of the brothers want Joseph dead, right? They're all in for killing him. But Judah, like, twists things around and at least saves his life. Like, maybe he wants the 20 pieces of silver, right? But it is more, you know, I read that as Judah is trying to find some way to save his life. He still hates Joseph, right? But he doesn't hate him quite enough to say, yeah, I want this guy dead, right? It seems like Judah saves his life.
I mean, he could have been good as dead as a slave. It's by pure luck and pure charm that Joseph was able to, like, achieve the life he did in Egypt. Most slaves, especially because he's just, like, a dude, he could have been put into a mine and died 2 years later from lung diseases, because even back in the day, like, mine workers and laborers had plenty of the same diseases that we have.
Well, I think that's more a case of God taking something bad and then managing to work something good out of it, as opposed to Judah, like, oh, I'll save his life by selling him into slavery. It's like God's more is like using that for a good purpose later on, I think, as opposed to, I mean, he does get credit for not bashing his brother's head in with a rock, I guess. Good on you, Judah. You didn't do that.
I was going to say, I don't think it's about what Judah did to Joseph. I think it's what Judah did to Jacob. It doesn't matter that whether Joseph lived or died. It's the grief that he caused his father, and the vengeance he gets is the grief he feels for the death of two sons and the fear of the death of a third one. That's the symmetry there. There's also something else here, though, going on, and that's this whole family. They're really messed up, and in particular, in this family, the oldest sons are all assholes. Ishmael and Isaac. Ishmael mistreats Isaac, and then you got Esau and Jacob. Every generation has happened, right? That the eldest son is the bad guy, and the younger son is the favored one and has the support of his mother and all of that. This is also what's happening. I mean, it's a little twisted, but it's Judah and Joseph as the favored older son. There's that rivalry. And I believe that then is replicated again in Er and Onan, also as the eldest son, who's clearly an asshole because God puts him to death for being an asshole. And then Onan, he gets put to death for something else that I'm sure we'll get into. But it's the same pattern again. That also gets broken with Tamar's sons, which is, I think, really significant.
Well, and like it's, and the fact that it's specifically not clear who was really firstborn. Like, is it, you know, is it who gets their hand out first, or is it the first one to get all the way out and breaking that tie there? That's fascinating. Any thoughts on Er's immorality? Because we're not really given anything in the text, just that the Lord considered him immoral, so God killed him.
The Midrash suggests that both of the sons died because they engaged in unnatural intercourse with Tamar. And Er, in particular, acted in this way so that she wouldn't become pregnant, for he feared that pregnancy would detract from her beauty. So, to me, that suggests this is the first evidence of the poop hole loophole. So that is the unnatural act that we are seeing here.
So, Elle, would you mind explaining what you've so eloquently put as the poop hole loophole?
It's anal sex.
So there is this theory in purity culture that basically you can remain a virgin as long as your hymen isn't broken, right? Now, of course, we know that hymens break all the time for all sorts of reasons, right? Like, women who ride horses tend to have broken hymens before they have sex. Hymens can break because you jog too rapidly, and hymens can break because of all sorts of things. And a broken hymen is not necessarily a sign that you have had sex, and it's also not a sign that you haven't. An unbroken hymen is not a sign that you haven't had sex. Like, there are ways to have sex and not break the hymen anyway. So, like, it depends on the person, it depends on the circumstances, it depends on all these other things. And I am not a doctor, so don't ask me too much about this. I'm especially not an OBGYN. But the hymen as this, like, pure sign that someone has had sex is just not a clear definition.
It's not a freshness seal wrapper that just like covers the entire vaginal canal either. Like it's there's a hole in the middle of it too. So it's not like, you know, it's not freshness guaranteed, okay?
The whole concept is weird and it's just a way of, it's just a means of control, right? It's attempting to have a science behind a superstition. That is part of it, right? Is that this, the hymen, the myth of the hymen basically makes women into a commodity, right? It makes virginity something that can be bought and sold, something that is, you know, the height of importance and everything. And so, like, having anal sex is how many people get around this, right, is to try and say, oh, we haven't had vaginal sex, the hymen isn't broken, so I'm still a virgin and I'm good to go, right? And it's just, like, we can't, there's no way of saying that anal sex isn't sex. Like, it's homophobic, it's it's all of these other issues that are going on there. I think that, you know, by any good definition of sex, anal sex certainly qualifies. But I think here in this story, right, I don't think we even need to say that Ayer's immorality has to do with that, just that for some reason he was immoral and didn't deserve to pass on children. But the problem here is that Tamar still needed to have children in her society because in a society that valued women based on their virginity and based on their ability to have children, she suddenly becomes a valueless commodity when she doesn't have those children, right? And so Judah is now obligated to give her another husband through a process called levirate marriage. Now, levirate marriage is exactly what this story is, right? Where you have a woman whose husband died without giving her children, and so his brother is obligated to then marry the woman and have a child with her. And that child will be viewed as her first husband's child, not as his child. And so that child will inherit whatever his brother inherits. Now, the added complication to this is that if you don't have a child that counts as that person's child, guess who inherits the wealth? The brother who didn't fulfill his obligation, right? Ayer also gets a birthright, right? Which is not just his inheritance. It's not like the inheritance would be split up between these three brothers. It would be split up into four portions, and Ayer would get two of them instead of just one because he's the firstborn. That is birthright in the ancient Near East. And so Ayer would get this half of the inheritance, and then his little brothers had to split the other quarters. And so Onan, seeing this, is able to say, well, I'm just going to take that land for myself, and I'll get three quarters of the land instead of just the quarter that I was going to get before. And what will Tamar get in the end if she does not have a child? Well, she doesn't get that wealth that she was entitled to as Ayer's wife. Now she is suddenly on the outside. And so leaving her without a child is the equivalent of giving her a death sentence in the society. She has no means of making money except prostitution. She has no means of gaining status in her society, right? She has no way of living a fulfilling social life without having to be degraded in being forced to go into prostitution, which was not a method of self-empowerment in the ancient Near East, right? She would have been seen as the least of the least of these, which is why Judah is willing to go and use this random prostitute on the way there.
There's even more than that because, like you say, Tamar has lost, as a woman, she has no power of self-actualization, no way to exert herself in any way because a woman had to be under the control of a man. So she had lived the first part of her life under the control of her father. Then she was passed over to the control of her husband. Now she's in the control of her father-in-law. The only way she can get any sort of autonomy over her life is to have her son, because ultimately that son becomes the man, the male who becomes in charge of her, but at least as a mother, she will have some influence on him. So that's the only out she has. Her only self-actualization is to have a son. You notice that in the Bible, this is a trope, right? The infertile woman. This is a story that's repeated over and over again in the Bible. So it happens with Sarah, it happens with Rebecca, it happens with Rachel. All of these stories, with Elizabeth and Samuel's Hannah and Samson's mother, and the list goes on and on and on, of women who can't have children. And when they do have a child, that child saves the nation in almost all of these stories. So, you know, especially with someone like Samson or Samuel, these are the sons who grow up to save the nation. Well, in this case, the children she's going to have are going to save the tribe of Judah from extinction. So Tamar is the absolute model of this woman who is unable to have a child and needs to have a son in order to save the nation. And she needs to overcome all barriers. But the amazing thing in this story is the barriers that stand in her way are named Judah and Er and Onan and Shelah. They are the ones who are the ones in her way that she needs to overcome. That's why she's like the best hero in this kind of story in the Bible. And that's why she really impresses me. And despite everything that's thrown against her, she overcomes. But also the weird thing is when Onan and Tamar can't have a child, presumably nobody knows what's happening in the tent, right? Presumably nobody's observing what's happening in the tent. But apparently everyone knows that it's Onan's fault, that he's the one who's putting his semen on the ground, which means that everyone has already concluded that Tamar must be fertile. It's not her fault, by which I read into that anyways, that probably Tamar has already had a child. And she maybe had a child with Er, with her first husband, but the thing was, it was a girl. And so that didn't count. So possibly in all of this, Tamar is a single mother. And she's not only worried about herself and providing for herself, she's also worried about some kind of future for her daughter as well. She's got all this going on, I think.
I think a reason that this passage continues to be misconstrued about masturbation, because it's actually about the deadbeat patriarchy and how they never fulfill their obligations of like the traditional gender roles that they enforce on everyone else. Because everything Tamar does is like what a good trad wife is supposed to do. And she's still like left out on the streets, and she has to take it upon herself and seize the means of reproduction for herself. The push for modern day, like traditional gender roles is this weird, like fucked up thing where men aren't actually asking for those traditional gender roles, and they're not wanting to be held up to the standard of the traditional gender role where they would actually have to take care of a woman like this. Or, and you know, I'm not just talking like, well, if you're son dies, you got to fix your daughter-in-law up with your brother or her brother-in-law. But in the, like, the traditional gender role pusher guys today, like, they want a woman to, like, do all the child rearing and the cooking and the cleaning at home, but also hold down the full-time job and also, like, not have a bank account with her own money in it. Whenever these, like, traditional gender roles are enforced, there's always, always this betrayal of them. Because you see this time and again for women in the Bible being betrayed by their own family and the men who are supposed to take care of them. And they've got to do their own finagling a little bit. Even the other Tamar, who is the daughter of King David, I don't want to go into it in too much detail, but I read something that was just so beautiful, and it also describes this Tamar. Tamar is a beautiful, good-hearted, obedient, righteous daughter who is totally destroyed by her family. And that's just like what happens to Tamars, apparently. That's why, like, at least in modern day, when you see this like push for traditional gender roles, they're based on lies. That can't happen. The obligations will not be fulfilled ever.
Especially under capitalism, which really, like, who can afford to be in a relationship where only one person is making the money? Like, you know, that it takes a tremendous amount of privilege.
Under capitalism, it takes an extreme amount of privilege. But under communism, one person working, and it doesn't matter who, should be enough to support a family.
The other side to this is that patriarchy, again, does not just destroy women, right? It also destroys men. In this story, very specifically, because this guy has one obligation to do under patriarchy, and instead of fulfilling it, he pulls out and gets himself killed. Like, he has one job under patriarchy, and he isn't fulfilling it. And so, by the rules of the system, he gets killed as well. And that just makes me think of so many ways that the patriarchy kills us, right? That one of the big reasons that men statistically used to live shorter than women is because men were often forced when they were young to go out and work really brutal jobs that would destroy their bodies and would lead to much shorter lifespans than men. And, you know, there are other reasons as well, but that is one of the major factors in the difference between the average life expectancy of men and women. And it's not something that is accounted for all that often in these ways. And it's not just the physical ways, right? It's the fact that the patriarchy is what sends off young men to die in these foreign wars, right? Where people will get involved in all of this fighting and go and be imperialistic because you have to prove that you're a man, and that gets them killed, right? And wars are started not because they want to actually accomplish a goal, but because there is a need in a society to say, we're not pansies, look at how tough we are. And so we go off and kill a bunch of other people and get a bunch of our people killed in the meantime, right? And that is all a part of a patriarchy that does not fully respect women and so cannot fully respect men either, right? When we look at someone else as lesser than, we are automatically putting ourselves somewhere on the hierarchy. If you are on the hierarchy at all, you are reducing yourself, because if you can't see the full humanity of everyone on that ladder, you can't see the full humanity in yourself either.
And there's more than that too going on here. I mean, it's even worse than that, because not only are women destroyed by the patriarchy, not only are men, individual men, destroyed by the patriarchy, ultimately in this story, it's the tribe, it's the family that is on the line. Because Judah's one job is what? He needs to guarantee the next generation. That's what this is all about. And when Er fails, and then when Onan fails, guess who fails next? It's Judah who fails, because apparently the rest of the community has all decided that Er and Onan are dead because they're wicked. But Judah hasn't decided that. Judah disagrees. He looks at Tamar and he sees Tamar is the one common denominator between the death of his two sons. And he is afraid of her. He is afraid of this Canaanite woman. And that's, and it says it, that's why he does not give his third son to her. And as a result, he jeopardizes the future of his own family. And that's what he's there for. That family is Judah's eternity. That's all he's supposed to do. He's supposed to guarantee that. And because of his fear of this woman and what she represents to him, he jeopardizes all of that because he won't give his third son to her. So there's that too.
Yeah, moving right along from the way that patriarchy hurts all of us, it is hilarious. It is this grand joke that happens in this story, right? Where she goes from being a prostitute to, later on in the story, a consecrated woman, right? Where we first think of this, we hear the word prostitute, and oftentimes in our society, as well as this ancient society, we think of prostitute as the bottom, right? The bottom, the people who are way down there, the people who it is very easy to make jokes about, right? And all these sorts of things. And then we hear this grand reversal, right? Where when he's going out to find her, when he's using her, she's a prostitute. But when he's going out to find her, suddenly she's a consecrated woman. She's a holy woman, right? She is someone who is supposed to be aspired to, right? And so talk to me about that reversal. And then the fact that at the end, where, you know, this is said sort of tongue in cheek, this is said to protect his dignity, right? That she's a holy woman. That at the end, he admits, oh, actually, she is the one who is more righteous than I am.
So when I saw the text and he asked, like, where's the consecrated worker? I kind of thought, like, maybe there was a particular role of, like, in ancient Greece, there were temple prostitutes. So I was kind of thinking along the lines of, like, well, maybe in this ancient society there, you know, for the poor women who had no male members to take care of themselves, like, maybe, like, that was looked down upon by other people, but, like, maybe there was, like, a consecrated role. Like, that wasn't, like, that bad. What I thought was funny was when people came back to Judah and was like, hey, Tamar was a prostitute and she's pregnant. He's like, burn her. Burn her. Tamar, my daughter-in-law, that whore. Like, the outrage. It so goes along with this, like, Madonna whore treatment of, like, men in patriarchal society where, like, the women they use as objects and throw away are worthless, but the women in their family that they own, they need to be their pristine little shiny selves. I didn't know if it was, like, a reversal from the prostitute to consecrated worker, or if consecrated worker was, like, an active role in the ancient Middle East like this, like it is in ancient Greece.
I do take the story as Tamar acting as a sacred prostitute throughout the story. But yeah, Judah might refer to her differently at different points. I probably, you know, there were fertility cults. She's a Canaanite. There were fertility cults in Canaan. Maybe she was a devotee of Asherah. And perhaps at times they would actually, you know, as an act of devotion, go to a sanctuary, and maybe this place was a sanctuary, and they would, as an act of devotion to the gods. And I suspect even that the whole thing with the veil is part of that. Now, the veil is necessary to the plot of the story because, of course, Judah can't recognize her, but it's also taken for granted in the story that the way you recognize a prostitute is that she wears a veil. And if she is a sacred prostitute, the idea might well be that, you know, various women who, as acts of devotion, offered themselves as prostitutes, as these sanctuaries, wore veils, with the idea being that the goddess also sometimes offered herself. And you wore the veil so that when you went into the prostitute, you didn't know whether you were actually going to a random woman, or you were actually sleeping with the goddess. So there might be some of that going on here too. This was a polytheistic time, very clearly. And, you know, Tamar is a Canaanite. There's at no point does it say that she is devoted to Yahweh, the God of Israel. She could well be a devotee of a fertility goddess.
The Midrash does say that Tamar was a convert to Yahweh. So it says that, but that's also, you know, the DLC.
What we've touched on here is actually a pretty live debate in the academic world, in the scholarly world. And so there is traditional interpretations that say, yeah, there was cult prostitution. But there's a paper by Eugene Fisher, I think in the 70s, that emphasizes the fact that that actually we don't really have a lot of good reason to think that that's actually the case in a lot of these stories. And there's also a paper by Lipinski that basically argues that, like, we often translate this term that way, but we don't have a clear distinction between, on the one hand, actual sex cults, right, or those sort of things that are implied by this idea of cultic prostitution, versus ceremonies that have a sexual connotation but aren't sex acts, right? So, like, you could say that the removal of foreskin is a ceremony with a sexual connotation, but, you know, as people who understand what that ceremony is, we wouldn't say that's a sexual ceremony, right? It's not a sexual ceremony. It's something that's done with sexual organs, right? But it's in no way a sexual performance. Well, it'd be pretty weird if you then started referring to people who performed circumcisions as cultic prostitutes, right? because that's a religious leader who's doing consecrated work and in the practice of their tradition that might be condemned from other sides, right? We see people today condemning the practice of circumcision, but we wouldn't go on to then disrespect their religion enough to say they're prostitutes because they're participating in this thing that has sexual overtones. And so I think we can leave the room open for both of those things, but I really prefer the interpretation that she is being considered here a consecrated worker, right? Where this is sort of a euphemism, right? Where he is not trying to say, have you seen this cult prostitute? I think that the servant of Judah is very much so trying to say, where is this consecrated woman? You know, this woman who was clearly a sacred woman, who my master would, of course, never sleep with a prostitute, but instead this sacred woman. And everybody kind of knows what he's saying because they're trying to help him save face as well. But they're saying, no, there is no such woman here, right? There is no holy woman here. And I think maybe even throwing it back in his face and saying, no, there's no holy woman here. We know what you're saying. And no, she's not around here either.
Again, another part of this is from Judah's point of view, because whether or not Tamar was a devotee or a prostitute, that's one way of looking at it. But very clearly, Judah sees it as a transactional thing. And he is absolutely, he just can't wait to get him some young woman is basically it. And that's the story. Like, his wife has died. He has taken the time that, you know, is culturally acceptable to mourn for her. And when it says it's time for shearing, apparently everyone knew what that meant. And shearing was a time when, you know, all, you know, what happens at the shearing stays at the shearing. And, you know, if there are young women around, that's the kind of thing. That's exactly what Judah is. That's very clearly what it represents. He is hot to trot, or however you put it. And he can't even wait to get to the flocks to start. He sees this young woman by the side of the road. He's just got to go for it. And for him, it's absolutely transactional. He says, I will pay you. I'll give you a kid.
Scott, one of the things that I love about your story, your retelling, in the Retelling the Bible podcast of the story of Ruth, right, is the fact that these guys were going out to the harvest. And what do you do when you sell the harvest? You have cash money for the first time, probably in a year. What are you going to go spend that on? Booze and women.
Especially because it's like as soon as Tamar hears, oh, Judah's going up to shear his sheep. She's like, oh, okay, I know exactly what I got to do. Like, okay, he's going to shear his sheep. That means we got to do the business. Okay, got it.
She knows where to be. She, like, this is not even a well-kept secret, right? Let's look at all the different facets of this, right? What is Judah's sin in this scenario? Not taking care of Tamar. It is not prostitution. It is not participating in a prostitute. It is not having sex outside of marriage. It is not masturbation. It is not pulling out. It is not birth control. It is failing to take care of the obligation that he had to Tamar, right? And the second sin he commits is hearing that his daughter-in-law has become a prostitute, like the prostitute that he just used, and condemning her to death because she was on the other side of a system that he had just used. There are so many modern examples, I can't narrow it down to just one.
It's just the nature of the deadbeat patriarch.
Yeah. And the double standard, yes.
The nature of someone who condemns people for fighting for their own liberation while full-throatedly supporting the people who are causing that oppression that causes people to want to fight for liberation, right? You can't have it both ways. He condemns her for doing what he just did, right? But the text does not condemn him. That's important, is the text condemns him because he fails to live up to the obligations he has to her, not because he participates in these sexual practices.
He only redeems himself by admitting to his to what he did and admitting she's far more righteous than me.
I do love the scene when, you know, she says, here, I'm going to charge you a kid. And I just love the scene when he's like there patting his pockets and saying, oh man, I just don't seem to have a kid on me right now. Can you trust me for it? And Tamar, of course, is all ready for this. And she asks, she knows exactly, obviously, what she's going to ask for. And I think it's very significant what she asks for. Because this is a very important thing she asks. So she asks probably for a cylinder seal that he would have worn on a cord around his neck and that he would have used to seal and to put his family mark on all of his property. So it's the symbol of his tribe and his family and, of course, his staff, which is also that. So this is not just individual ID she's asking for. She's asking for something that represents the entire tribe of Judah, the entire family. And basically what he does here, this is a really important symbolic act. He hands over these symbols of his tribe. So he's essentially admitting that he has failed his own tribe, his own family. He's failed to preserve it because he was afraid to give his son to Tamar, because he was afraid of this woman. He has failed his family, and he essentially passes the fate of his own family over to Tamar at this point. And I mean, I'm sure in his own mind, he's writing it off and saying, oh, I'll get it back, and I just need to get laid. It's been way too long. My wife died. But that's what happens in that moment. He passes his entire family, his future, his eternity over to this woman, and she takes ownership of it because he has failed.
Kind of like what happens with Jacob and Esau. Esau is not thinking straight, and so he sells his birthright. Judah's not thinking straight, and so he sells the birthright of future of his tribe.
He's not thinking with his head. He's thinking with another body part. Yes.
That means don't do anything with your birthright. If you're horny or you're hungry, take care of those first and then consider giving up your birthright.
Don't make decisions when you are in need of something, right? To feel level, right? That's just good general advice, but it's something that just comes out so much in this story that they are thinking very carnally. They're thinking about what they need right now instead of what they need in the long term, instead of what their obligations are in the long term, right? And again, this comes back to a critique of capitalism that always only thinks about what happens next quarter, right? How do we make a profit the next time our numbers come out, instead of how do we take care of our workforce in the long term to ensure that they are happy and healthy and live productive lives, right? How do we make sure that we are contributing to a better world, right? Now, companies might say that on the surface, but nobody's actually thinking about it when you look at what their quarterly numbers are and see that they fired half their staff to, you know, make their stock price raise by 2 cents, you know? it's ridiculous. And that is the short-term thinking that has resulted in a world where so many of us are working longer and harder for less and less because it's being taken away from us, because people aren't thinking about the obligations that we owe to one another. It's just about, how can I get what I want right now?
That's all of them except Tamar. Tamar is the only one, yes.
Tamar, yeah. Tamar is the only one who's willing to use tricks to get what she needs to actually protect the society, right? And again, Tamar is not condemned in this story. Tamar is said that you are more righteous than I am, right? That Tamar is the just one, right? Tamar is the one pursuing justice. Just a friendly reminder that our liberation theology siblings will tell us to constantly replace the word righteous with the word justice, right? Whenever you read it in the Bible, just replace it with justice. She is more just than I am. She is pursuing justice better than I am because I didn't allow her to take my son, Shelah, right? Any last thoughts on that story before we go into the last couple of names?
I would just underline the fact that with all of that taken into account, you realize that this is not the story of Judah, the patriarch. He's a total failure throughout this whole story. This is the story of Tamar, the matriarch of the tribe of Judah. And that's what she is. And through her extraordinary courage and the choices she makes, she is the one and the only one who saves the entire tribe of Judah.
It's worth remembering, it's got briefly mentioned before, but it's worth remembering that in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew, there are a lot of women in the book of Genesis. Tamar is the only one that Matthew mentions. And she's chronologically she'd have to be, but she's the first of those five mentioned. She's without her, none of this happens.
Sabotage is an approved holy method of getting things done, including in your workplace. Sabotabi approves of Tamar.
There are some anarchists that in the Bay Area, right? An area that has a lot of industry that's going through there. And they went and they put aluminum foil on the train tracks. Now, that is something that's not going to harm any of the workers there, right? That's not something that's going to cause harm to the people who are actually living there and trying to just make a living, right? It's not going to, you know, throw over a train. It's not going to cause any harm to anybody. But it does put hours delay on the manufacture of weapons that will be going and used in the state of Israel to bomb Palestinian children, right? Every hour that we can delay that happening is an hour worth fighting for, right? And it took just aluminum foil, right? And that's the sort of thing that Christian anarchists should absolutely be involved in, right? If you consider yourself a pacifist, that is the kind of intervention that we have to be making all the time because we are able to slow things down, right? We saw the Suez Canal disaster and how one ship being in the wrong place could grind the international economy to a halt, that could destroy entire businesses because a boat went sideways in a canal, right? And now we're seeing the genocide of the Palestinian people in part because the state of Israel wants to build an alternative canal so that that sort of thing doesn't happen again, right? And that much work can happen from that little action, right? And so we can have big effects if we take the small actions and the small protests we need that will protect the lives of the people we're fighting for and make a dent in the economic effect and the economic profits that war profiteering and the exploitation of the poor happens all throughout the world.
A general strike takes a very long time to prepare for because you need a strike fund and to prepare for food and to make sure everybody gets what they need. But remember, lockdown ended not because it was safer during the pandemic, but because the economy was on the verge of collapse. And by economy, I mean the rich people's yachts going vroom. We're that close to ending a horrible economic system that hurts us all. We're that close. Even non-participation in certain aspects of the economy, that hurts them. That's a protest too.
The last thing I want to talk about really quickly here are all the names that happen in this story. Just to talk through these names, particularly because they go along with the Midrash, right? Where Air means to be observant, right? To see things, right? And it could be said that Air is sitting here observing Tamar's body, and he doesn't want to ruin that by pregnancy. And then Onan's name, right, where Onan means strength or power, right? But he doesn't actually live into that strength or power because he spills his seed on the ground. He wastes his power. He wastes the thing he could be using to lift someone up and empowering them, and instead wastes it for his own benefit so that he can get his inheritance from his brother and so that he can get all of those benefits for himself. And then the name of, in contrast, Perez and Zerah, tell me what those names mean and what effect that has on the story.
Zerah means glowing / dawn, and Perez means breakthrough or breach. And like, his name is that because it's pretty obvious. He pulled his brother back, was like, me first. But that's the family, like Perez is the one that the family line is traced through. Glowing Dawn. I mean, you know, it's a new beginning for Tamar.
Yeah, him and Shelah, we never hear anything from him again. He says, oh, he grew up and then Judah didn't give him to Tamar and he didn't matter in the grand scheme of things.
I tend to see it as this subversion of the story that's been passing down through this whole ever since Isaac and Ishmael, of the enmity between elder and younger brother. And this finally seems to get subverted by these two in some way.
Well, and these two's names are the breakthrough, right? The breach, the break in things that have happened, the moment of revolution, right? And Zerah means the glowing dawn, the new light that has come up after this thing has been broken, right? And so I love that we have Er and Onan doing these sort of things. And then their little brother, Shelah, that just means that undresses, right, or unties. Maybe he undresses himself, but he doesn't get involved here in the actual line of Judah that goes on to be the ancestors of King David and ultimately of Jesus, that these are the people that are bringing liberation, bringing salvation to their families, just like Scott was saying before.
I do want to point out that Perez is still technically a little brother to Aaron, Onan, and Shelah. They're brothers. If Judah and Joseph are brothers, then Perez and Onan are brothers, you know?
And can I just throw in the parallel to the other story? Because the daughters of Lot also produce two children, also by having sex with their father, not their father-in-law, but it's very, very similar. And I'm always struck by everybody reads that story of the daughters of Lot, and they say, oh, well, that's about just dumping on these other nations and their origins of Ammon and Moab, because that's how they were conceived. But the entire tribe of Judah is descended in almost exactly the same way. And yet nobody says that about this. And so I think that people are unfair to the daughters of Lot. I think they're also the heroines of that story as well. And the parallels are very important.
I don't know if you've listened to our episode on that one yet, but I agree with you.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, like, I remember back when that episode aired, they through Ruth get back into the line of David and Jesus too. So like it all connects. And
I absolutely agree that like women taking the power that they need in these circumstances in which they have no power is the best and most holy thing that they could have done for their families. Right. And you know, as much as I want to laugh about the fact that, oh yeah, these are my brother nephews, or or in the case of Lot, right, oh yeah, this is my brother son. You know, far more importantly, it is the fact that these women did what they needed to do right by their families, right, and to have justice and to make a life for themselves in a system that was terrible and unjust and all of these sorts of things. And we can certainly look at these stories and say, the fact that the system is set up this way is fucked and it's awful. And you know what? The way that our system is set up is fucked and awful. And how can we find ways to use our trickster nature, to use the best of our abilities to escape that and to change it and to come away giving birth to a breakthrough that leads to the dawn that we all desperately need.
I do just kind of want to like push a little bit against thinking about the grander family and the tribe and the bloodline, because that's often like an alt-right talking point to like be overly concerned with the bloodline. Tamar was focused on herself. She was focused on like securing her future. Like, yes, she had a broader future, like a little bit in mind, but she couldn't see beyond the bigger, the great plan. She wasn't concerned with what was going to happen to the bloodline once she had a son. Like, it was more about taking care of those immediate needs. And oftentimes when we're struggling and we're like overwhelmed and are like feeling it in this world, the best thing to do is to like shrink back a little bit and like focus on what you need now in this moment to get through it, to survive. And then it will work out. It will go on.
Take care of yourself. Yes.
None of us are that special to worry about the bloodline. What will be, will be.
I think that's a really profound point as well, that like, you know, we can dream about revolution. We can dream about the big changes that happen, but most of the time what we can do is the good that's right in front of us, right? And taking care of the need that's right in front of us. And, you know, getting that person who needs a coat, getting that person who needs a meal, and that is revolutionary enough. And God can use that simple taking care of the person in front of us to bring about the change that we need. All right, friends, thank you all again for a wonderful episode. It was wonderful to have you, and thank you, Ben, for coming on for the first time. Dear listeners, please check out Retelling the Bible podcast. And thank you, everyone, who continues to share this podcast all over the place. I so appreciate that y'all are bringing it to places that I'm not even talking about it and and making this just so much more than I thought it was going to be. It's about a year ago, we started off this thing with just the hope that we would talk to some people who cared about the Bible and maybe we'd have a couple good conversations. And here we are a year later with people on almost every continent listening in, people of almost every leftist political stripe that I've ever heard of coming and being united in this community. And none of that would be possible without you. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Now, Pastor Micah, take it away.
Thank you, Future Micah. And of course, you, our wonderful listener. Together, we have made a wonderful and growing community on Discord that I look forward to being a part of every day. Your generous support on Patreon has already greatly increased the quality of our podcast, including this very outro. As an extra little thank you, you can get episodes early along with a bunch of other cool perks. Please follow the link in the show notes to join our Discord, Patreon, and all of the other things mentioned throughout this episode. If you would like to reach me directly, you can reach me through the Discord or by email at thewordinblackandred@gmail.com. Now, Future Micah, say the profound shit.
And thank you, Past Micah. Now go and do the good that's right in front of you and pray that that is enough, that that justice can start something that brings about the salvation of our tribe and of our world. Shalom.